The next step in the development of the Niger controversy was the president's 2003 State of the Union address, which largely focused on the threat posed by Iraq. He delivered the speech as rhetorical and military preparations for an invasion were intensifying and Saddam continued to defy demands from the United Nations Security Council. After talking at some length about the Iraq regime's continued pursuit of chemical and biological weapons, as well as its ties to terrorism, the president briefly and ominously alluded to the greatest fear-provoking claim that the regime was moving forward on an advanced nuclear weapons program. The president had already stated that Iraq could build a nuclear bomb within a year if it acquired necessary fissile material, such as uranium. Now he uttered what would become known as the 16 words, his first personal reference to the Niger uranium claim. The British government has learned that Saddam Hussein recently sought significant quantities of uranium from Africa. Those 16 words would become the nexus of the controversy that delivered a near fatal blow to the credibility of the president and his administration. As the push toward war continued, President Bush and others in his administration continued to make the case for action against Iraq. Because of Secretary of State Colin Powell's enormous bipartisan popularity, as well as his unquestioned honor and integrity, the White House recognized that he would be the most logical and persuasive person to help seal the case at home and abroad. So on February 5th, Powell made a special presentation before the UN Security Council concerning the Iraqi effort to develop and stockpile weapons of mass destruction. This presentation did not include the Africa claim. After carefully scrutinizing the intelligence, Powell had chosen not to use it, a decision that in retrospect was both wise and highly revealing. Still, that claim remained in the public mind one of the most potent bits of evidence in the administration's case for war. After all, the threat of nuclear attack by Iraq seemed far more frightening to most Americans than the more remote danger of a chemical or biological attack on U.S. soil. That is why the words of National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice on September 8th had made headlines. The problem here is that there will always be some uncertainty about how quickly Saddam can acquire nuclear weapons, but we don't want the smoking gun to be a mushroom cloud. Then, just as America was on the verge of war, the Niger claim was seriously undermined. On March 7, 2003, days before the president launched Operation Iraqi Freedom to disarm and topple Saddam's regime, Mohammed el-Baradei, the director general of the UN's Nuclear Inspection and Verification Arm, IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, made a startling statement in remarks to the Security Council. The uranium intelligence was not credible, and there was no evidence or plausible indication that Iraq had revived a nuclear weapons program. Furthermore, he implied that the documents on which the Niger claim had been based were forgeries. Based on thorough analysis, the IAEA has concluded with the concurrence of outside experts that these documents, which form the basis for the report of recent uranium transaction between Iraq and Niger, are in fact not authentic. We have therefore concluded that these specific allegations are unfounded. 2 days later, Secretary Powell was asked about el-Baradei's remarks by Tim Russert on NBC's Meet the Press. In response, Powell stated that the uranium information was provided in good faith, and if it turned out to be wrong, then fine. But he asserted to Russert that it was still an open issue to be investigated. Then he went on to restate another key administration talking point about how we had previously underestimated Iraq's nuclear capabilities. "We have to be a little careful about nuclear weapons programs," Powell warned. "We saw the IAEA almost give Iraq a clean bill of health in the early 1990s, only to discover that they had a robust nuclear weapons program that they had not discovered." Powell was correct that intelligence reporting had previously underestimated the threat from Saddam Hussein's regime. His remark underscored many officials' lack of trust in the UN Nuclear Inspection Agency, which some White House and administration officials used to convince themselves with an overabundance of certitude that the Iraqi regime was a real and growing threat in a post-9/11 world. In any case, doubts about the accuracy of the Niger claim did little to slow the momentum toward military confrontation. On March 19th, the war with Iraq began. In a March 31st New Yorker article, Seymour Hersh discussed the Niger documents and flatly called them forgeries. Though Hersh was known for his liberal views and therefore discounted by many on the conservative side of the political spectrum, He was also considered by the mainstream media to be a diligent reporter with good contacts in the policy arena, and his articles shone a spotlight on doubts about the Niger documents. The idea that the Bush administration might have based part of its argument for a controversial war on inaccurate intelligence was one thing. Most Americans would be inclined to forgive an honest mistake, especially if it stemmed from an excess of caution about a perceived threat in a dangerous post-9/11 world. But if administration leaders deliberately chose to ignore the facts when assembling the case for war, and even worse, if they knowingly dissembled in order to make the case appear stronger than it was, Americans might not be so forgiving. That was the new, far more potent charge leveled in a New York Times opinion piece written in May 2003 by Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and Iraq war opponent Nicholas Kristof. In his column, Missing in Action Truth, Kristof drew on information provided by an anonymous, albeit credible, source to suggest that the administration had deliberately misled the nation into war. An unnamed former U.S. ambassador to Africa told Kristof that he had been sent to Niger to answer questions from the vice president's office about Iraq seeking uranium. Kristof wrote that the unnamed envoy reported to the CIA and State Department that the information was unequivocally wrong and that the documents had been forged. The envoy's debunking of the forgery was passed around the administration and seemed to be accepted, except that President Bush and the State Department kept citing it anyway. They were tough words, written by a prominent liberal columnist for what many consider the national newspaper of record. Doubts about the veracity of the Niger claim had been around for a long time, but Kristof was now suggesting something far more sinister, that the administration had cited the uranium claim, knowing it was unequivocally wrong. The specific accusation being made by Kristof and his unnamed source fed into a broader, already burgeoning controversy over how the White House had used intelligence to make the case to Congress and the public for justifying going to war in Iraq. As U.S. forces swept through Iraq, the discovery almost everyone expected them to make, large WMD stockpiles, was failing to materialize. In response, administration critics, particularly the more partisan ones, were starting to charge that the president had deliberately misled the nation by exaggerating or hyping the intelligence to justify war. At best, critics of the Iraq war believed that the president had not been straight with the American people. They believed that he and his advisors had likely ignored or disregarded caveats and contradictory evidence about the intelligence to make the threat from Iraq seem more serious than it really was, and thereby create a sense of urgency and gain necessary public backing. While Kristof's column did not generate much immediate interest from the national media, it did get noticed by the White House, particularly the vice president and his office. And not unlike the Clinton White House, which quickly and aggressively countered criticisms, the Bush White House began taking steps to aggressively fight back. The vice president, whose credibility and integrity were specifically being questioned, and his office would take a leading role in these efforts, beginning in late May 2003. Through inquiries at the State Department, the vice president's office quickly learned the identity of Kristof's unnamed source. It was former Ambassador Joseph Wilson, who'd been sent to Niger to investigate the uranium allegation in January 2002. Under the cloak of anonymity, the vice president and trusted aide, Scooter Libby, soon began an effort to discredit Wilson with selected journalists. Unknown to anyone else in the compartmentalized, internally secretive White House, including the White House Chief of Staff, the National Security Advisor, and the CIA director, the president declassified key portions of information from the October 2002 NIE for the vice president and Libby to use in this effort. At the same time, Libby and other high-ranking administration officials, including Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage, Karl Rove, and then-Press Secretary Ari Fleischer, would anonymously share another piece of classified national security information, the identity of Joe Wilson's wife, Valerie Plame, and her role as a CIA employee in helping to arrange Wilson's investigative trip to Niger. The purpose of these leaks was to discredit Wilson by undermining his public assertions that he had been sent to Niger by the CIA at the vice president's request. But the circle of those who knew about these leaks was very small, and some of those who participated didn't even realize that Plame's identity was a state secret. These decisions, to defend the president and to launch a stealth campaign to discredit Joe Wilson and expose his wife's CIA role as part of that campaign, would have profound long-term implications for the credibility of the Bush administration. As the effort to discredit Wilson was getting underway, I was still deputy press secretary. I had just been tapped to replace Ari Fleischer, who'd announced his intent to leave in the middle of July. So my duties were still focused elsewhere, and therefore I had no knowledge of the anonymous efforts to expose Plame and discredit Wilson. The 16 words controversy was still taking shape and did not grow legs until early July 2002, about a week before I assumed my new position. At the time, like others in the White House, I viewed Wilson's assertions as a malicious attack with partisan overtones. I knew of no real justification for questioning the case for war and felt no reason to question it myself. I trusted the key members of the president's team, and I had no reason to doubt the president's integrity. Of course, I realized that the administration was engaged in some back-and-forth jockeying with critics on Capitol Hill and in the press about the pre-war intelligence and the case for war. But I felt it was all part of the modern-day Washington game, a permanent campaign between two sides, each trying to shape and manipulate public approval. As far as I knew, we were simply doing what we had to do, fighting back against unsubstantiated, malicious charges that the president had knowingly lied in order to take the nation to war. The partisan warfare of the 1990s was once again taking center stage, and the media were all too eager to cover who was winning and who was losing. Clouded in controversy once again were the larger underlying truths, including how the White House had made the case for war. The resulting drama of secrecy and deception, of charges and countercharges, was playing out in the theater of political power, Washington, D.C., and I found being part of the play exciting. While politics had been a focus of my life for as long as I could remember, I never imagined one day being cast as a prominent supporting actor in such a widely watched and historically significant drama.